Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is Police Against the Movement, the Sabotage of the Civil Rights Struggle and the Activists Who Fought Back, a talk by author Joshua Clark Davis to mark the publication of his book of the same name. Joshua Clark Davis is an associate professor of U.S. history at the University of Baltimore, and his research has earned awards from the Fulbright Program, the Silvers Foundation, and the NEH Public Scholars Program. He's joined by moderator Chenjerai Kumanyika, host of the podcast Empire City, and son of Herb Callender, a 60s-era civil rights activist who later changed his name to Makaza Kumanyika. The talk took place on November 6, 2025, at The Word is Change, a radical bookstore in Brooklyn, New York. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station.
I'm going to tell one quick story and then stop for the time being. And it's a story about a man named Mahmoud Mamdani who came to the United States. You've probably heard that name, Mamdani, before, right? And so this is his father, of course, who was from Uganda and came to the United States in 1965. And he was at the University of Pittsburgh. And somehow he got mixed up with some civil rights radicals from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, SNCC, who are all over this book. And they convinced him, hey, you're new to campus, but let's go down to Alabama. Let's go to Montgomery. His son has spoken about this. And what happened was at protests in Montgomery, police attacked them. I think they used fire hoses. Mahmoud was arrested. He was jailed. He called the Ugandan ambassador for, you know, some legal help. And the Ugandan ambassador like really chastised him. Like, what are you doing? You're not supposed to be doing this. And he said, well, I'm trying to help people fight for their freedom. We just got our freedom in Uganda 3 years ago. So shouldn't we be supporting them? And the ambassador was not impressed by that. Several weeks later, back on campus, and I think he was living on campus, but Mahmoud Mamdani got a visit from two men in trench coats who were FBI agents. And they wanted to interview him. Well, we heard you had a problem. We heard you were mixed up in a protest. Why were you doing that? One of their lines of questioning was, do you like Marx? And he said, Marx, I don't know him, no. They're like, no, he's dead. And he said, oh no, I'm so sorry to hear that. This is why you're here. Why are you coming to talk to me about this dead man? I said, I didn't know him. And they said, no, he's been dead for a really long time. He was a writer. He wrote about poor people and about how they should not be poor. And he said, that sounds amazing. And they left. They maybe were tipped off by Montgomery police or maybe the ambassador from Uganda or maybe both. But they left. And in the coming weeks, for the very first time, he went to the library and looked for writings by this guy, Karl Marx. And he has acknowledged publicly, that's how I learned about Marx from these FBI agents. So long story short, even though Mahmoud Mamdani is not in my book, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, the Montgomery Police, and the FBI in their acts of police repression have some stake in the Mamdani family's road to socialism. I mean, I'm just going to say it. That's from his dad. I'm not making that. You can find it online. So I wanted to say that because that's, we should mention that family this week here after you guys got some pretty nice news. And created some news, right? Didn't just get the news.
Welcome to the People's Republic of New York.
Yes. And I want to say also, I really am happy that Chenjerai is here as moderator. And we'll be talking some about why we're having this discussion. There's multiple reasons, and some of them are very, very personal.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that was a great handoff. This book is really important. I want to lay out a story that starts to talk about why. You know, my father was a civil rights activist in New York, and I knew that growing up. You couldn't ignore it. I mean, he was crucial to who he was. I kind of knew that some of our extended friends, like my friend Howard Quander, was in the mix with him, but I didn't really know quite what they did because you're just growing up. All through, if you walk like down the hallways, there's like pictures of my dad with Kwame Ture, my dad with Martin Luther King, you know, in the pic. So you knew he was in the mix. But by the time, you know, I was came to the age where I could ask questions, he was doing something different. He was working with farmers and we were, you know, he was trying to get his degrees and stuff like that and trying to figure out his life after a lot of this. And also he died in 93 and I have pictures of him, but I never had any kind of like moving images of him because we didn't, you know, video wasn't really readily available. It wasn't like, I think about that all the time. You see people with like Instagram and all this, they got of their people. And I'm like, dang, I wish I could have my dad moving. You know what I mean? I want to see him like moving and remember how he used to, you know, how he used to move. And I just kind of had resigned myself, said, well, that's what happens. I'll never see that. Except that one day I did. I had started working on the podcast Empire City, partially because I felt the way we talk about police was insufficient. And essentially a friend gave me a tip of a thing I already knew about but hadn't looked in. I'm looking through these files and suddenly there I'm looking at my dad, the surveillance footage of my dad. I didn't realize it was, I realized the surveillance footage for a minute, I forgot, because I'm sitting there looking at black and white, clear footage of my dad, younger than me. See him there, he's moving around. I'm like, yo, that's him. I'm like, I'm having all these emotions. And it's literally, I'm looking through the camera of the NYPD. And that fact that the NYPD had cameras which were good enough that I could see clear footage that made me feel things of this event, which by the way, my dad was with several activists handcuffed inside of a police station at a protest. It made me ask some different questions because I said, you know, most of the conversation I see about police gets reduced down to questions of, was it okay for this officer to use a chokehold? Or here's some evidence that shows that this officer didn't really fear for his life or feared for his life. It was like all these anecdotal questions about use of force or this and that. And I'm like, yo, this video of my dad that's making me feel these things raises a whole different question, which is why was there an entire taxpayer-funded apparatus inside the NYPD that was stopping people who were asking for really basic things? Like, you know, people, you know, they were like filming. You go through that bossy archive, it's like they're filming people who are like rent strikes, school desegregation, things that today would be not controversial. And so I started to kind of talk about this, in closing, as I pass it to Josh, I was like, I'm a kind of historian in the sense that I try to be a historian through my documentaries, but I was like, I feel like there's a lot of narratives about the police that are interrupted. One, that the main questions are about like what's on camera and incidents of violence. We should be talking about something totally different. And the second thing was that I felt like I grew up always hearing like, yeah, J. Edgar Hoover was the one who set up all the infiltration. Once they saw the power of black leaders like Malcolm X, like Martin Luther King, J. Edgar Hoover was like, we have to prevent the rise of a black messiah. And then he sent these agents down and they suppressed the movement. You know, a lot of people told me that narrative and that's what I grew. But I was like, this feels like this was coming out of the NYPD itself. This was not, maybe the FBI was involved, but the NYPD had a robust apparatus that was distinct from the FBI. So Police Against the Movement, reading this book was emotional because it introduced me, as we'll talk about, to my dad's work in policing in a way that I hadn't understood. And it puts that question about what do we talk about when we talk about police right at the center of the conversation. So every chapter of this book, you're going to be like, oh my God, it's a combination of like, how did I not know that? And this redoes what I thought I knew about these moments, right? So it sounds like we had some similar worries about the way that people talk about the problem of policing. What did you think was wrong? And what was the thing that kind of motivated you and started to take you down this path?
So I guess like 10 years ago plus, you know, when this fairly new movement, Black Lives Matter, was really on the rise, there was a really superficial way that news media were reporting on it. Historically, I mean, in general, the media are not interested in history, but there was this prevailing narrative, not coming out of the movement for Black Lives, but coming out of the media, that BLM is getting to the work the civil rights movement never got to. BLM is continuing the unfinished work because, hey, remember, like, the civil rights movement of the 60s, they just got their ass kicked all the time. And here, let's show you some very graphic footage of police in Birmingham unleashing attack dogs on Black children. And here, let's show you footage of the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. And there's John Lewis and
it's O'Connor.
It's also iconic. Yeah.
Yeah.
And in no way was I thinking that was not significant. It's just terrible acts of violence. But I think the thing that I thought the problem or just the question that the book started with was, okay, well, what did the civil rights movement do about policing? Is it true that they really did nothing? Because the prevailing narrative was they suffered it. They endured police violence, but they couldn't fight it. It was just like impossible. They couldn't resist it. They couldn't have done that. Maybe at the March on Washington, John Lewis or even Dr. King said things about it, but that was it. They couldn't go further than that. And so I just wanted to know, like, what did this movement say and do and fight in terms of police violence? Was there anything? And the more I started researching, the more I saw this was a really important part of that 60s civil rights movement. And, you know, for a lot of folks, the narrative also was, well, it wasn't until the Black Panther Party that radical activists in the 60s started fighting back against police violence. And, you know, again, this is in no way diminishing what they did in the BPP because it was tremendous. But for me, it was, again, wondering, well, that come out of nowhere? Was it really... A lot of folks in the civil rights movement were not doing things about police violence, but what about the more radical activists in the movement, in groups like SNCC, in groups like the Congress of Racial Equality? And so that was part of the motivation. And as I got more into the research, the motivation also grew to be, what were the different types of violence that police, I guess, did to activists? Yes, physical, but we had this dichotomy in our heads. Local police used physical violence. They weren't very sophisticated. Sometimes they got caught on TV and then they got in trouble. J. Edgar Hoover is like this, you know, almost like supernatural supervillain who was just like a master of deceit. And as, you know, he accused the communists of being, and it's all about him versus King. And so for me, a lot of this question was, but what about police intelligence units? NYPD probably left behind the biggest repository of police surveillance records concerning social movements that exist today because activists in the early 70s just sued the hell out of the police and ended up winning after a 14-year constitutional battle. And that's why today, if you go to your NYC municipal archives, they're on, what is it, Chamber Street, right across from City Hall, they have all this old film footage. And this was me saying, how does a civil rights movement look differently if we put the battle against police violence at the center of it? And the more I researched, the more it was like, we have really forgotten how much of the movement was about this. We have forgotten that it wasn't just something that folks picked up in the late 60s or 70s or BLM, but that radical activists within this movement were saying, it's not just physical violence, it's also legal violence, it's also surveillance, it's also infiltration, it's also trumped up felony indictments. And we have to fight it. So that's, in a nutshell, the problem. I mean, I didn't know that's what the problem was at first. But after several years, it's like, oh, that's what I guess I'm trying to write a book about.
You know, you talked about the other kinds of violence, like the fact that the sort of Black Lives Matter period was defined by the spectacular instance of violence caught on camera. You know, I started to kind of have this way of thinking about this problem where I said, the idea, in a way, of everything being on camera was the idea that everything is before our eyes, the act of violence that you need to be in. And that's what seemed so outrageous, was that someone's being killed before your eyes and yet you can't get any kind of justice. But then I thought about it and said, actually, the things we need to understand about policing are actually like before our eyes, right? Like not on camera. And so in the book, you talk about slow violence and these mechanisms, all these other mechanisms. Could you give some examples of what you mean by slow mechanisms of violence that we're going to see and maybe like any examples of how that plays out in these movements?
I did not come up with this concept of slow violence. There's been other thinkers and scholars who said, you know, and people who are looking at environmental racism, they're looking at gentrification. They're saying not all violence is physical. Some violence is legal, it's technological, it's slow in its effect and its execution.
Lawfare.
Right. Yeah. And spent 7 years writing this book, and probably it occurred to me at like year 6.5, better talk about slow violence. Like, that's finally the concept that kind of describes what I'm trying to get at, which is physical violence is terrible. It breaks bones. It tears off limbs. It kills people. And yet, in the 1960s, liberals, and particularly white liberals, were justifiably scandalized by seeing these just brutal, unrepentant acts of physical violence on camera against civil rights activists. But they fell into a trap of thinking that's the main weapon being used against the movement. That's the way that movements are hurt, is it's got to be physical, and we'll know it when we see it. And it's only years later where people were discovering, through things like the theft of the FBI documents from the FBI office outside of Philadelphia in 1971 in Media PA, where the anti-war activists, like, really just kind of bravely and absolutely unbelievably broke into this FBI office and pilfered a whole bunch of FBI files during the Ali Frazier fight. That's why we know about COINTELPRO. And that's in no way to diminish what COINTELPRO was, but just this story of, like, okay, if it was sophisticated and it was used against the movement, then that came from the top, the FBI, that came from Hoover. And for me, this concept of slow violence became a way to understand, you know, so many police around the country did not like the civil rights movement, did not like protesters, wanted to stop those movements and slow them down. When they saw what Bull Connor did, the police chief in Birmingham, Alabama, when they saw what the people did in Selma being brutalized, they said, you know, that was dumb. Like, it's not like, I think they generally felt like terrible. They felt like that was so stupid. Why did they do that? They studied it and they learned from these physical attacks that if you want to break movements, disrupt them, stifle them, you have a whole range of legal tools, not just jailing people overnight. We're talking about felony indictments that put someone under a cloud for years and potentially could result in prison. Like, right now, this is what happens to folks, for example, a lot of Palestinian solidarity activists, the Stop Cop City folks in Atlanta who still have like felony charges hanging over them. And then the weapon of surveillance. And, you know, it's kind of a larger philosophical question. Well, does surveillance hurt someone if they don't know they're being surveilled? And the more you learn about state surveillance, the more you learn that one of the main objectives is intimidation and fear and trying to sow the seeds of distrust and trying to kind of break the empathy and solidarity and trust that makes movements work. So many police departments across the country were using these tools, and they were much, much more sophisticated than, say, the Alabama cops, who said, we don't care if we get caught brutalizing these people on camera. And that was why this concept of slow violence to me became so important.
Could we just slow that part down? Because I thought what you said was important, which is that surveillance, on one hand, you're like, you're gathering data, right? You're performing for the person who sees themselves being surveilled, like you're in public. So it was like a chilling. Mm-hmm. But what I hear you saying is something also that it sows a kind of, and deepens a kind of, nurtures a sort of distrust, where movements happen because of solidarity, you know. But when you start to look around and you feel that you're being surveilled and you're like, I mean, is this right? You tell me if this is kind of what you're talking about. You're like, you have to worry, like, are you calling me? How are you? That cost that you caused the movement, that sort of raise the costs in a way on solidarity and sow distrust, that actually attacks us in a different way. Is that close?
Yeah, it's all right, we all have to be on signal now, because even if we're asking someone what they're having for dinner, you never know who could be, you know, on your phone. And it's obviously, if no one suspects surveillance, then it's not going to be a concern. But the thing was, you had these police intelligence units and departments all over the country. They're very close to the ground. They're known as red squads. They're anti-radical units. And they very frequently made their existence known to activists. Mm. It was like a guy in a suit at a rally who doesn't belong there. He's taking down names. It's, you know, you see the same guy 4 out of 5 days in your apartment building, and he doesn't live there. So, yes, it's a chilling effect, but it's also this effect of making people distrust each other, right? Because if you start hearing stories about how a police officer might infiltrate an activist group, then who's next? So it's not just getting that intelligence, that surveillance. And yeah, you're talking about being a historian. Most surveillance is boring as hell. When you get into these files and you start reading it, you're like, this is so mundane. Okay, so they went to that rally again. Great. You got 10 license plates. Exciting. But it's like the amassing of the surveillance adds up to narratives to delegitimize movements. So it's often not in the minutiae of the reports. It's not like the exciting I spy detective work. It's more the narratives that are used to try to delegitimize and discredit movements, sometimes publicly and sometimes internally in police departments.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is Police Against the Movement, the Sabotage of the Civil Rights Struggle and the Activists Who Fought Back, a talk by author Joshua Clark Davis to mark the publication of his book of the same name. He's joined by moderator Chenjerai Kumanyika, host of the podcast Empire City, and son of Herb Callender, a 60s-era civil rights activist who later changed his name to Makaza Kumanyika.
The stories itself in this book are fascinating. And, you know, my podcasty self wants to not give you spoilers, but I'm going to, because I'm going to use the movie trailer because you're going to forget, and then you'll read, and then you'll have the pleasure of, oh, wow, again. But, I mean, there's so many good stories. So what I'm going to start with one personal story that connects. So I'm going to give you the way the story I got as a kid. You can give me the better version. All right. Story I got as a kid is, your dad's crazy. He tried to arrest the mayor of New York, right? They would say this, right? Sometimes they would like threaten me with it. They'd be like, yo, you know, watch out. Your dad's crazy. You know what I mean? He tried to place the mayor of New York under citizen's arrest. And I was like, okay, that tracked with what I knew of my dad. I was like, big dude. He was, you know, he's. And later, I'll do it like this. A graduate student one time was like, yo, have you ever heard that your dad tried to place the mayor of New York under citizen's arrest and then was sent to Bellevue? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, I did hear that. And he's like, have you ever seen it? And I was like, no. And he said, well, he sent me some pictures, right, of it. And I saw it in the newspaper. I'm like, oh, wow. And I'll stop there. So that was what I kind of got. I never talked to my dad about it. Mm. What's the real story?
So I'll try to tell this concisely. The NYPD had a secretive police intelligence unit called the Bureau of Special Services, also known as BOSS or BOSSY. It existed for many, many decades. It actually, the predecessor of it predates the FBI. Same with the Chicago Red Squad. And it kind of waxed and waned. They're called Red Squads because they go after Reds. But basically, with the Red Scare really destroying the Communist Party, they kind of needed a new reason to live. And I think a lot of these Red Squads found it in the civil rights movement. In 1964, they started in the NYPD to basically amp up infiltration efforts to break into activist groups, not just to watch, but to disrupt. And in April 1964, and this was after people like your dad in the Bronx chapter of CORE were beginning to picket the NYPD, were beginning to protest, were doing, you know, sit-downs on the Triborough Bridge. Sit-ins on the road, basically. And so in April 1964, the BOSSY, this secretive unit, hired two brand new black police officers who had never been to the academy and kind of talked them into, hey, you want to do some exciting work for us? And I think in a way really didn't explain to them what it was going to add up to.
Right.
There were two of them hired on the same day. One was this guy named Gene Roberts, who, if you've ever seen any of the terrible pictures of Malcolm X's assassination, they were in Life magazine. There's a light-skinned man on the ground kneeling over his body with a pencil-thin mustache. He's Gene Roberts. He is Malcolm X's bodyguard who was at the scene of the murder. This is a larger question about whether he was involved. I would say probably not, but he was undercover in activist groups for years. Infiltrated the Panthers too and was part of the infamous Panther 21 trial. Fanny Shakur, Tupac's mom, famously confronted him on the stand when he was asked, hey, did you help murder Malcolm X? He said, no, of course not. And she said, you lie. That's another story. But on the same day that Gene Roberts was hired, was this guy named Ray Wood who was hired. And Ray Wood, they said, hey, you need to go become a member of the Bronx chapter of CORE, and you need to watch this guy, Herb Callender, Chinjari's dad, and he's making so much problems with protesting the police. You need to just ingratiate yourself and do stuff for them and enter their chapter. And he became a member of CORE for many, many months. And the big scheme that he pushed was, hey, Mayor Robert Wagner is violating New York State anti-segregation laws. And hey, New York State has a citizen's arrest law. So let's do a citizen's arrest on the mayor at City Hall.
And they told him, right?
Well, that was part of the law. You were required to notify these telegrams. Dear mayor, we are letting you know that we're providing you notice that we're going to place you under citizen's arrest. And it didn't go well.
Yeah.
It didn't go well. And I mean, you know, God bless your dad and this guy, Bobby Valentine, I swear that's his name, for trying it. Because they did actually have a point. It's like maybe the mayor is breaking the law by supporting discriminatory construction projects. But it really looks like Ray Wood pushed that idea. Let's do this. Let's go for it. Let's arrest the mayor. This will be a great idea. And that's what landed your dad in Bellevue psychiatric ward for like 5 or 6 days. After that, another long story, but I'll try to say it briefly. Ray Wood infiltrated a group of black activists and basically said, you know what?
Hold on, slow, because this one is good. There's so many good ones. All right, there's so many stories I can't choose. I mean, because we got like Mike Hannon, you know, I'm really interested in that one, but I'm going to give another version where I got the story. You give the better story. I talked to a guy whose name is Reggie Wood.
Mm-hmm.
He's a mysterious figure who I'm still not sure a lot about him, even if he's even legit. I'm just going to say this. But Reggie Wood told me, we got on the phone, and he said, you know, when I was growing up, I had a cousin named Ray Wood.
Mm-hmm.
He said, in our house, we had a picture of Ray Wood, and he had two criminals that he had apprehended because they were trying to blow up the Statue of Liberty.
Mm-hmm.
And we were proud that cousin Ray had gotten the bad guys. And we always grew up like, man, cousin Ray went to New York, he got the bad guys, you know what I'm saying? And they had the picture, and that's what the story he told me.
Mm-hmm.
What's the real story?
Man, coming to like the...
Sorry, I don't even roll out.
Coming to the New York National Archives regional branch, and they like bring you like two of those boxes. It's like, oh, goody, there's a 1,200-page court transcript. Now this is what I'm going to try to turn into something that people will actually not fall asleep when they read. That was like, whatever, 8 months of my life. I don't know. But basically, after Ray Wood talked your dad into trying to arrest the mayor, landed your dad in Bellevue Psychiatric Ward, it appears that this secretive unit boss basically told Ray Wood, you got to do more. You got to find more dangerous activists. You got to get in deeper and get more people who are trying to do worse things. He infiltrated this tiny group that was called the Black Liberation Front. And they were people who were interested in Cuba, at least one had been to Cuba. And in February 1965, they were arrested for trying to blow up the Statue of Liberty. And it was national news all over the country. It was all over the New York press. It was like, yeah, these three black radicals were trying to blow up the Statue of Liberty to, I guess, dramatize the hypocrisy of America. And they got federal charges. And it was like the whole plot had been uncovered by hero cop Ray Wood, who they had his picture all over the press, national media, but it was always with his face concealed. And these three men ended up being convicted. And there is just ample evidence in the court testimony that Ray Wood just encouraged the plot over and over again. These guys didn't really seem interested in this idea. And Ray Wood said, well, here's the U.S. Army Explosives Manual. Give it some thought. Here's some gasoline. Here's some fuses, all paid for by the NYPD. You know where we can get some dynamite? We know these, like, Quebecois separatists in Montreal. Let's drive up to Canada. I got a car paid by the NYPD. Me, Ray Wood and this guy, Bob Collier, drive to Montreal, try to get these explosives. They don't. Weeks later, these Quebecois activists bring down the explosives, and that's when everyone gets arrested. And it's like, these guys end up going to prison for that.
That was well done, really fast. I appreciate that. Thank you.
But it's a terrible act of state violence because I'm not a lawyer, but I tried to learn a lot about what entrapment looks like. And this guy really advanced that plot and pushed it and promoted it. And two of those three men are still living. Walter Beau actually lives in Brooklyn, and I was talking to his wife this week, and he wanted to come, but he's 95. And I was really lucky to interview him in 2020. Another man named Khalil Syed in Texas, I got to interview him. He was one of these people who got sent to prison on these charges. And they really, you know, they shared their story with me, which is spilled all over these federal court transcripts. But, you know, they fortunately went to prison like only for like 2 or 3 years, but it's the hero cop. And, you know, there's a whole nother side story we're not going to get into, but that plot was foiled, I can't remember, 5 days before Malcolm X was killed. And there's all these speculations about whether this guy, Ray Wood, was involved in that. You mentioned Reggie Wood.
Right, because those guys, part of their job was that they were part of his security contingent.
Yes,
right?
That Gene Roberts guy, hired on the same day as Ray Wood. And this letter that cousin Reggie Wood found, he produced it after Ray died. He said, I got the letter where my cousin Ray admits that he helped to kill Malcolm X. And we're not going to get too deep into that. We're going pretty NYPD deep on this because this is a national book.
I'm tempted to go back even further because I'll just say that one thing that really was eye-opening for me was I was surprised to learn at first through my father how much they had waged a specific battle against the NYPD. But then I'm now learning about even before my dad, like Ella Baker and you know, I heard stories that my dad and my used to, you know, my mom remembers sitting with my dad at Ella Baker's feet. You know, I'm like, Mom, you tell me this now? You didn't tell me this all these years. But let's go elsewhere. Let's go to Los Angeles because I think one of the central insights in the book is that, I mean, you say it in a sentence, and I just remember you said, listen, local police innovated when it came to like this kind of Red Squad work. They were the innovators, right? I got to say, one fascinating detail was when police departments were first trying to figure out how to network with each other, am I correct that FBI was actually against it for just a brief moment?
Yes, because the FBI wanted to kind of run the show and kind of be the storehouse of surveillance. And there were all these beefs. William Parker was the chief of the LAPD, and he was kind of the second most famous lawman in the country. And J. Edgar Hoover hated them. They hated each other. And basically a lot of like West Coast police departments started something called the Law Enforcement Intelligence Unit, where they were basically saying the FBI doesn't give us enough surveillance and intelligence. We got to start doing our own. They said it was for organized crime, but it often drifted into political surveillance. But yeah, so there's these beefs. It's not like everyone in this profession likes each other. It's all kinds of like jockeying for glory. And
so I want to talk about the LAPD, and I, you know, again, this is my sort of podcast curation brain here. We're always looking for like interesting characters who we can follow through a kind of amazing journey. And this book is full of such people, but one is Mike Hannon. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could share a little bit about Mike's story, because part of what caught me about it is we have now like several accounts. Like we had, you know, we even have like a, you know, we have a full blockbuster film, you know, Judas and the Messiah, you know, shout out to the Lucas brothers for doing that. But this to me challenges almost every piece of that narrative, the Mike Hannon story. Mm-hmm. Like however you get taught about what these sort of provocateurs, how they function. So do you know why I felt like it challenges all these things? And how does this shift what we need to understand? Because I think, I just want to be clear, like we're having fun telling stories, but I think this book really shifts the kinds of questions we should all be asking, movement people, people who are going to try to support whatever happens further, and scholars in terms of what our focus is. So how does the Mike Hannon story direct us in better directions?
So Michael Hannon was a white cop in LA, in the LAPD. And I don't know, he kind of came from a middle-class background. He didn't come from like a line of cops, but he said, that's how I'm going to get a good government job in 1960. And then over the course of a few years, he legitimately became a socialist. And he got kind of like turned into a socialist by like Pacifica Radio. I think it's KPFK out there. You have WBAI here, right? And
right,
he got basically turned out as a socialist. And
he was signed up in the organization.
Yeah. No, he was a member of the Socialist Party. And
right,
that's,
yeah.
You know, this is like the Norman Thomas era. It's not like DSA. It's not, in some ways it was kind of a aging party, but it was a left-wing political party that mounted candidates and, is often forgotten about, not the communists and not, you know, people like Socialist Workers Party, who I'm not going to get in tonight because of stuff.
Yes.
But basically Mike Cannon said... he became a socialist, and then he became interested in the civil rights movement, and the civil rights movement is unfolding, and he joins CORE. Again, in the civil rights movement, there's kind of four main groups: NAACP, most of you know, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, that's Dr. King and the Baptist ministers, SNCC, those are the shop troops, the only youth-led, black-led organization that's like, you know, Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael, John Lewis, Judy Richardson, Ella Baker, all these folks. And then there's CORE, which your father was in. They have chapters all over the country. Hannon gets involved in CORE in LA. He's not doing this to infiltrate. He's not doing this to deceive. He is like maybe the only socialist cop of that era. I'm sure there were others, actually. I don't want to say he's the only one, but he legitimately says, you know, racial discrimination is a problem. I've got to get involved in this movement. And then he says, hey, I'm a cop. And the LAPD is extremely racist, and it's flooded with, you know, propaganda by the John Birch Society. It is like they're trying to recruit me to far-right organizing in the police house. He doesn't start to go public with it, but his colleagues, he starts getting really negative reviews. Like, at first, they were like, this guy's going to be a great cop. 3 years later, they're like, he's controversial. He gets in fights with everyone in the break room. He's an agitator. Cops start seeing him at CORE protests in LA, and they're like, this guy is a traitor. William,
like, he's not like in uniform. He's at the protests.
Yeah, and he's not even doing civil disobedience as much as he does things that are pretty tame. Like, these civil rights activists are about to like maybe beat the out of this like neo-Nazi who comes to the protest, and he basically stands in between them and is like, nonviolence. And the cops are like, we do not like this guy.
Nobody's perfect.
And so there's like, he starts, you know, he does unsigned editorials in the CORE newspaper about how racist the LAPD is. He does like editorial cartoons that are unsigned. But basically, Chief William Parker, second most famous lawman in the country, basically throws the book at him and says, we're charging you with all these acts of insubordination that are unbefitting of a cop. And they had this thing called basically, it's an administrative trial. And before him, virtually every cop would skip the trial. They would just like plea, like, okay, yeah, I smoked in the police car, or yeah, I was bad on the shift. But he got these radical lawyers to defend him, and they held this very lengthy trial to challenge the charges. And so, you know, it's not a representative case at all. And it's not a white savior narrative, but it is like there is this committed white anti-racist who basically says, it's not just that I'm white, I'm working for this racist organization and I have a duty to start exposing it. And the more they try to kick him out of the department, the more he goes public. It's a national campaign. People are trying to save his job. And eventually he gets suspended, not kicked out, but he's in law school and he becomes a lawyer who, you know, starts suing the LAPD. And years later, he kind of had a weird political transition where he went kind of right-wing, like decades later.
Wow.
But for like decades, he was doing good work.
And also they assigned an undercover cop to him, right?
Yes, and he was infiltrated and there was like this Nicaraguan student who basically was recording him and then was like a cop who later became like a right-wing radio personality in LA.
Come on. Agent provocateurs who infiltrate the socialist white cop. Come on, people. I mean, that's drama.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is Police Against the Movement, The Sabotage of the Civil Rights Struggle and the Activists Who Fought Back, a talk by author Joshua Clark Davis to mark the publication of his book of the same name. He's joined by moderator Chenjerai Kumanyika, host of the podcast Empire City, and son of Herb Callender, a 60s-era civil rights activist who later changed his name to Makaza Kumanyika.
We talked about some of the things in the book. I mean, what is really important note that you want to leave people with before we go into Q&A about this book? You work so hard on it. You make so many interventions. It helps me understand the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement totally differently, and the organizations in it. I mean, what's on your heart to sort of close out on?
I guess it's like, one, the civil rights movement endured all kinds of state violence that we don't necessarily think of as being carried out by local police. But two, they also fought back against it. They picketed, they protested, they had sit-ins in police stations. They did not accept it. It's not everyone in the civil rights movement, but it's certain radical activists. I think the other thing for me, I didn't realize that this book was going to be a lot about historical memory until I was getting towards the end of it. And it was kind of like, okay, what does this book actually do other than just catalog state violence and then also powerfully document people who fought it? But like, what is useful about it? I'm not a legal expert. I can't teach people like, this is how you abolish the police, or this is how you want to keep the police, this is how you fix them. That's not what my book does. But I think what I came to realize is, like, say what you will about like James Comey, okay? But the FBI, at least for a while, they publicly said things like, you know what? We spied on Dr. King and that was wrong. And they're doing it for political reasons. And I mean, they literally had like classes for FBI agents. Like, you should learn about why COINTELPRO was bad. We don't do that anymore. And, you know, we can debate the sincerity of that, but it's like, they at least acknowledged like, we shouldn't have done this. This was a form of violence. Local police have never, the NYPD, Chicago PD, LAPD, all over the country, north, south, east, and west, they have never said like, oh, we attacked this movement left and right and tried to stop it. I mean, they're falling over themselves come every January. We want to salute Dr. King for his inspiration to our profession. Hey, and then 5 months later, why don't you look at our like Juneteenth themed patrol cars? Like, if you're telling those stories, I mean, obviously people are not falling for them, but at the same time, it's like this whole profession refuses to tell any truth about their concerted effort to sabotage this movement. And you find it not only in their silence, but open up a policing textbook if you want to suffer through it. And you'll be like, oh, that's what they're saying the civil rights movement did. That's what, and they'll say things in these policing textbooks like J. Edgar Hoover was bad, FBI, they got out of hand. But, you know, it was a hard time. It was a controversial time. Go to the National Law Enforcement Museum next time you're in DC if you want to suffer through a few hours. Like, see what they say about the civil rights movement. It is so far from honest. So for me, it's like, hey, if they say they want to change and they say they want to end racism and they say they want equality in their profession, and we can be extremely skeptical of that, but if they're claiming that publicly, they can't even ask us to listen at all if they don't acknowledge any of this history. It's just beyond hypocrisy. It's not like shocking that they do that, but it's like, pushing this narrative of, hey, we can fix ourselves. It's like, you know, and especially not if you don't acknowledge his past.
Right.
So for me, that was a really important part of ending this book, is like, oh, this is about the memory and how people have this very blinkered view of what the civil rights movement did and did not do and what it suffered through and who it fought and things like that.
Yeah. Absolutely. No, thank you. And the only thing I'll add on, turn the questions over is, as somebody who picked up the fight against, you know, essentially policing, I kind of, at times, because it's such a repetitive cycle and you feel like you don't win, you know, I knew that I was fighting in a tradition that, you know, with the Panthers and certain other folks, but I didn't realize how deep that tradition was. And I also didn't realize how deep that tradition went, even in my own family. But beyond my family, that's sort of not that important. What's most important is just that it's a deep tradition and that it has different tools that I think we need to learn from as we tackle public safety going forward or whatever the issue is, empire, all the other things that we want. So
that's a good question. So for the audience, police surveillance and repression of the civil rights movement was, there are a lot of evidence of it growing out of top-down orders that were explicit directives, or was it just kind of an inevitable kind of outgrowth of the ideology? That's what cops would do, so they did it. One thing I really wanted to focus on this book is these police intelligence units, red squads, and how explicitly and intentionally local police departments not only created them, but at different times directed them to do more disruptive things, greater acts of infiltration, and how it may not have necessarily come all the way from the top like the commissioner, although in many cases the commissioner strongly encouraged this, but it certainly came from the top of these intelligence units. And maybe this seems like it is in like cops' nature, but I think that it's a very intentional project to create a political intelligence unit. And it's some of the most complicated parts of this book in general. And for me, we're thinking about Black undercover officers who were sent to infiltrate Black movements. And one of the things that kind of became clear to me over time is, in many cases, maybe those undercover officers did want to disrupt movements, but also just so apparent how white leaders tokenized them and just like held on to them for dear life, not only for like the practical reason to infiltrate movements, but also like politically talking about their work against the movement. They would trot out a lot of these undercover officers after they were unmasked to like testify before Congress. Like Ray Wood testified in Congress.
Right, yeah, you know? Right.
And so they're undercovers from Houston who did that. And these intelligence officers, they were always white led. But they, in many ways, I think, pushed Black officers to do more and more often. They didn't realize what they were getting into.
Yeah, you talk about that, how really a lot of these guys didn't fully understand what they were signing up for. And it's unclear what they would have chosen if they did, but they mostly didn't and just, you know what I mean?
And what's also complicated is that I think some of them regretted it. And then some of them, like part of why this whole letter that Reggie Wood found, supposedly is a letter that his uncle wrote about being involved in Malcolm X's killing. Part of what I think some people have been skeptical about is a lot of things about it. But like, I found a record from a business that like Ray Wood established in like 2018 in the state of South Carolina, like some dumb LLC.
Right.
And the name of it was like Bossy Man. It's like he's still talking. He's still identifying.
Still proud, right.
Yeah, in 2018. Yeah. And it's like, that guy, I don't think he wrote a deathbed confession.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I don't believe it. And there's other things about it. And, you know, there are other historians who might say no. But
there was nothing in his letter or in Reggie Wood's account that you couldn't verify elsewhere. That was the thing.
There is a very good historian, Garrett Felber, who wrote a very good letter about this document that he found in an archive where someone said that they heard that Ray Wood was at the Audubon Ballroom when Malcolm X was killed. And almost all those details show up in this letter that was later found. So I think the way that I talked about it was that these red squads, what's important about them, we don't have exact estimates, but first of all, like in the late 60s, FBI probably had about 3,000 agents devoted to political intelligence. Red Squad officers across the country, it was like close to 5,000. But the question was about the relationship. There is competition there, but my sense was that again and again in cities like New York, Houston, Chicago, that the political intelligence units, it's like an elite unit within the police department. They're typically detectives, and that's, you know, considered like you're not a beat cop. Like it's kind of the ethos is like we are the we're the scholars. We're the ones who look carefully. We read a lot. We clip a lot of newspaper articles. We do intelligence. And I think what the FBI did frequently was to rely on them for information they wanted about certain people. So, like, for example, in this case with the so-called three Statue of Liberty would be attackers, exploders, Ray Wood was the guy on the inside for weeks, probably trying to foment this plot, and he kept going back to his superiors, and he's like, this is real. These guys are trying to explode it, even as he's advancing the plot. And his superiors finally are like, I guess we better tell the FBI because these guys are driving to Canada and they're going to bring explosives across the border. At the very least, we would like it if they don't stop them because we want that crime to be committed. Not at the point of explosion, but like we want them. I mean, they literally, these Quebecois separatists brought dynamite all the way into New York. And this cop, Ray Wood, was like, oh yeah, meet up with me. Like, let's meet here.
And they did stop them, but not. But
yeah.
They didn't.
I mean, it was in Riverdale. It right. was like in front of this apartment building. Like, they're like, put the dynamite in the ground. And Ray Wood met this guy, Bob Collier, and said, show me where it is. And anyways, the FBI knew nothing about any of this until the NYPD Red Squad said, we think you guys should know about this. And the FBI was skeptical. I think the FBI often thought some of these schemes were kind of harebrained. But I think eventually the FBI met up with Ray Wood, interviewed him. I think it was the Ritz-Carlton or no, Waldorf Astoria. And, you know, they write a report after interviewing him for 3 hours. They're like, this guy checks out. He is, you know, a well-spoken officer. You know, they kind of fall into some of these stereotypes. So the FBI relies on these Red Squads often. I think you're right. Maybe you didn't say this, but I think there is a hint that the FBI looks down on these Red Squads in some ways, and they don't always trust them, but they also rely on them. There's tension in that relationship, but they need them. And so the FBI notoriously, you know, what is it? The movie you just, Judas and the Black Messiah, right? You know, that guy whose name I'm forgetting, who basically orchestrated the murder of Fred Hampton in a lot of ways. This doesn't make it any better, but he was not an FBI agent. J. Edgar Hoover was terrified of the idea that FBI agents got caught doing that kind of stuff. He always said, let's farm it out. Let's pay someone to do it who's not a member. Red squads across the country actually had their own officers going in to these activist groups, and that may seem like a fine distinction, but I think in some ways these red squads were even more... I don't want to say daring, but like more reckless in some ways and more willing to say, let's do this.
But they also knew the landscape better, right? Because they're there, yeah. Right? They know that, yes. They know the people, right?
They're
so they have
to
a
the
more
ground.
Fingertip feel. But also the way you talk about the origin of this relationship, we talked about it a little bit now, but like even the origin of these Red Squads, right? Like, you know, at Empire City, I went down this rabbit hole a little bit and it was like, oh, okay. So there's, you know, this Italian squad.
Mm-hmm.
And this Italian squad we talk about a little bit in the show exists before the FBI.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. So it's already, and then that's going to lead to this kind of like lineage. I don't want to do too sloppy with the history here that eventually kind of like funnels into Bossy. But you were talking about those initial moments where police are trying to network with each other
mm-hmm.
and the FBI is seeing it and wanting to control it. Didn't local police departments create another entity before the FBI? There was another thing you talked
yeah,
about.
Yeah, well, that was the LEIU, and it was this West Coast thing we were talking about, trading information and surveillance, and we don't know a whole lot about it. It's like a private foundation. I was going to say very briefly, I know we're getting later, but one of the crazy things about Red Squad federal collaboration, to your question, is Ray Wood and Gene Roberts' superior, the guy who dreamed up all this infiltration, was this guy named Jelosiewicz. I'm forgetting his first name, this Polish guy. He ended up becoming one of the Watergate, not burglars, wow. But he became a Watergate bagman, and he delivered money to try to pay off different burglars and to try to get them not to talk. And he testified in the Watergate hearings. So there was, in the Nixon administration pulled not one, but two different people from the NYPD Red Squad into the federal administration. I mean, so there's...
That dude is one of these dudes who's still like totally unapologetic about the world.
He wrote a whole memoir about it. And his license plate was, what was it like, Watergate? It was like the Polish word for water and then gate. I'm not kidding.
So the Greensboro Massacre,
and probably most people have heard of it, but it was members of the Communist Workers' Party in North Carolina in 1979 holding an anti-Klan rally and were attacked, and five or six of them were killed by members of the Klan. And yeah, just tremendous documentation to show that the police knew that there were probably going to be attacks, and they like spent 5 or 10 minutes not going to the scene. And that was in 1979. And I talk about it some in terms of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission they had in that city, and people can debate the effectiveness of those. But it is one of the things I propose in the conclusion, which is, could a Truth and Reconciliation Commission about the police's attack on the civil rights movement even be possible, even if it were like non-governmental? Could organizers do something like that? But the incident that really stood out to me about vigilante and police collaboration was the Freedom Rides of 1961, which very notoriously, when activists, black and white, got on the buses in Greyhound, went down to Alabama and were violently, violently assaulted to the inch of death in some cases in Birmingham and in Montgomery. Civil rights activists suspected that the police intentionally didn't go to the bus stations. And so that's been circulating for a while. But the thing that I discovered that was really powerful to me was that the Congress of Racial Equality did something called the Inquiry into the Administration of Southern Justice during the Civil Rights Struggle. Like in 1962, they held a tribunal to say, we really want to look at what happened in Alabama, because we think that it's not just the police are targeting the movement, but we think they're collaborating with far-right organizers. And they held this public tribunal. They tried to get the press really interested. I mean, the members were big time. It was like Kenneth Clark, a pioneering black psychologist, who did, you know, it was Norman Thomas, the head of the Socialist Party. Eleanor Roosevelt was the chair. And Eleanor Roosevelt presided on this committee. And they tried to get all this press involved, and no one cared. And I.F. Stone was one of the few people who wrote about it. And he said, this is really sad that there were so few people interested in this thing. And Eleanor Roosevelt wrote like months before she died, that's one of the hardest things I did, because I was shocked by how many people I trusted were not outraged by the fact that police were working with Klan's members. It's essentially your implication. And so that dynamic is present in the book, and it's disturbing, but barely no historian has ever written about that. Like, it came up a line here in this book and that book. And seeing the picture of Eleanor Roosevelt, it's like she's like dying. She's really like in her last months. And she believed in confronting that state violence and the way in which state violence connected with far-right activists. And they thought it was dangerous, and most people wouldn't listen. And so, yeah, it's a very important thing to talk about.
Thank you. Well done. Yes. You've been listening to Essential Dissent. This episode was Police Against the Movement, The Sabotage of the Civil Rights Struggle and the Activists Who Fought Back, a talk by author Joshua Clark Davis to mark the publication of his book of the same name. He was joined by moderator Chenjerai Kumanyika, host of the podcast Empire City, and son of Herb Callender, a 60s-era civil rights activist who later changed his name to Makaza Kumanyika. The talk took place on November 6, 2025 at The Word is Change, a radical bookstore in Brooklyn, New York. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station. I'm Wilton Vaught, saying thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.